This is Beverly Tomasian. Welcome to our webcast, Diabetes Tots to Teen Standards of Care. This is a really exciting presentation because there have been a lot of updates in the management of type 1 and type 2 diabetes with children for a lot of reasons. Number one, I think we're gathering more data and there's more science behind management of tots to teens with diabetes, but also because the numbers are increasing both with type 1 and type 2. So the American Diabetes Association has written the new standards of care outlining care of kids with type 1 diabetes, but also the American Academy of Pediatrics has written a document on care of type 2 diabetes in children. So we'll be looking at both of those highlights from those different standards during this presentation, and then we'll be wrapping up with talking about behavior change and helping people with diabetes, and in particular kids with diabetes, successfully manage this really complicated condition that requires a lot of work. So I hope you have your handouts with you, and let's get started. So here's our topics, the standards of care for type 1 and type 2 diabetes in children, all the way up to their teenage years when they move into adulthood. We'll look at normal growth and development and optimal glycemic control. We'll really focus on how do we help kids live the healthiest life possible with type 1 or type 2 diabetes, because you know if you get diabetes in your teen years, for example, you're going to be living with it till you're 78. That's the average life expectancy currently. So 60 years living with a chronic disease is a long time. So we'll be talking about positive psychosocial adjustment, not only for the child, but also for the family, because it certainly is a family condition. And then we'll talk about self-care. So let's take a look at the incidence of type 1 in youth. So type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune condition, and it usually happens right around the age of 14 or during puberty, because the pancreas is more stressed out from the pubertal hormones and there's more insulin resistance. So type 1 is an autoimmune disease, and it's higher in Caucasian Americans. You can see the rate here per 100,000. The rate is lower in African Americans and other groups. 151,000 children under the age of 20 in the United States currently has type 1 diabetes, and the rate's doubling every 20 years. So when we think about the rates of diabetes going up, we generally think about type 2 diabetes, but the truth is rates are also going up with type 1. There's many trials underway to detect and help prevent, and we'll be talking about TrialNet a little bit later. So certainly a type 1 is a condition we're going to be seeing more of, and our patients are living with type 1 much more successfully. So we want to find out how to help them have the best quality of life and looking at those standards. But when we look at type 1 new diagnosis in infancy is rare, but there does seem to be a bit of an increase in very young children getting type 1. But it is true that 75% of all new cases of type 1 are diagnosed before the age of 18. So that means that 25% of type 1 cases are diagnosed after the age of 18. So type 1 can happen at any point in your lifetime. It's just most likely to happen before you reach adulthood. 30% of new cases of diabetes present in ketoacidosis, and that's why, generally speaking, type 1s get care very quickly after diagnosis, and it's usually detected. There are some situations where DKA is not suspected or type 1 is not suspected, and it can lead to serious consequence for these very hyperglycemic children. So you want to, you know, just kind of make sure our emergency rooms are aware of the signs of DKA and appropriate testing and treatment. And for our community, how would parents know if their child has type 1? Well, generally, autoimmune disease would run in the family, so we would already be looking for type 1 expression, because maybe another family member has type 1, or thyroid, or celiac disease, or other autoimmune condition. But the complaints include nocturia, anuresis, so wetting the bed suddenly, and then weeks of polyuria, so just really going to the bathroom a lot, thirsty, weight loss, tired, infections. Polyphagia is rare, so they're not starving, but they just don't feel good. They're sluggish, going to the bathroom a lot, maybe losing some weight. And then when we do the labs, we'll see that they're hyperglycemic. Yes, they're spilling sugar in their urine, and then they're also burning fat for fuel. So anytime you see this ketonemia or ketonuria, that tells us we're insulin deficient. And when people are insulin deficient, they can't use glucose for fuel, so they go to an alternate energy source. They start burning fat for fuel. When you burn fat for fuel, it leads to ketone bodies. Ketone bodies make your blood very acidotic, and that's where the pH starts to drop. So anytime you see somebody with diabetes with positive ketones or ketonuria or anemia or emia, we know that they're insulin deficient because they can't use glucose for fuel. It's always a sign of insulin deficiency. And of course, unless it's a starvation ketosis, but most of the time in this situation, it's due to lack of insulin. So I like to ask them poll questions. Once a child is diagnosed or a person is diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, what percent of beta cell function remains? Is it 20% A, B 20 to 30%, C none, or D 15 to 40%? Let me go ahead and launch this poll and see what you have to say. New diagnosis of type 1, what percent of beta cell function remains? Thanks for voting, everyone. Just take your best guess. There's no right or wrong answer, but it just is a nice way, these polls, for me to interact with you since I can't see you, which is really difficult for me. But at least doing these, and I think these polls are helpful because I try and focus on key points, you know, those take-home points for your practice. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close the poll, and actually we have a tie here. 50% of you said none, there's no beta cell function, and 50% of you said 15 to 40%. So I'll just go ahead and share those results with you really quickly, and guess who's right? Well, I used to think it was none. We used to say that for a long time. Once you get type 1 diabetes, you make no insulin whatsoever. Actually, that's not the case. The correct answer is here. By diagnosis, 15 to 40% of beta cell function remains. This is called the honeymoon phase. You've heard of it. People will say, oh, he's still in the honeymoon period. And that's where the beta cells are still pumping out some insulin. And the length of the honeymoon varies. 10 to 15% of teens and adults still have clinically significant insulin production 5 years after the onset of diabetes. 5 years. Rate of beta cell loss correlated with age. So the younger you get the type 1 diabetes, the more quickly your beta cells die off. So if you get it later, you might have more beta cell preservation. Well, how is that helpful to know? Because with TrialNet and the new studies coming out, what they're trying to see is, can we save these remaining beta cells? The more beta cells that we can save and help function throughout the person's lifetime, the better their blood sugar control is and the less glycemic variability they experience. And we know from the Joslin study that many patients with type 1 diabetes for over 50 years still have some beta cell functionality. So this is a real message of hope, and I'll talk about the studies that are out there a little bit later, getting our patients into those studies to see if we can't preserve beta cells. So here's some more information about type 1 diabetes. 3 million Americans are living with it, and approximately 80 people per day are diagnosed with type 1. 85% of people living with type 1 currently are adults, 15% are children, because as you know, children move on to adulthood. So most of the type 1s we'll be interacting with are grown-ups, you know, adults after the age of 18, but 15% are kids with newer type 1. The rate of type 1 incidence among children under the age of 14 is increasing, so we're seeing it happen at younger and younger ages. And you can see it accounts for a lot of our healthcare costs, $15 billion a year. And so the American Diabetes Association, in their latest iteration of the standards of care, have really taken a serious look at management of children and adolescents. They talked about it in the 2014 standards as far as some unique features of type 1 diabetes. But in this edition, they've really nailed down goals clearly. So this is the first time in a long time we've had an update on the management targets for kids with type 1 diabetes. So I think it's really well put together and summarized, and it's based on evidence. And I have on your resource page put a link to the article on the standards of care. and that you can take a look at. It's section 11 in the standards of care. So they made the new standards in chapters, and it's really makes accessing the information you want a lot more easy. A lot easier, maybe, is a better way to say that. So what are the recommendations for glycemic control? So for the next few slides, maybe the next 20, we'll be talking about type 1 diabetes. What are the targets of care? And the A1C goal is 7.5 across all pediatric age groups. There used to be a differential A1C based on their age category, but now they're just saying they got rid of that. It's less than 7.5 for all age categories. But they do say something really interesting. Rationale right here is that a lower goal is reasonable if can be achieved without excessive hypoglycemia. So we might adjust that goal if the child is successful in reaching the A1C target of 7.5 and they're not getting too much hypoglycemia. But I like here that you can see the blood glucose range is 90 to 130 before meals. As you know, in adults, it's 80 to 130. In children, we want to provide a larger safety net to make sure they don't get too hypoglycemic. And then bedtime or overnight is 90 to 150, a little tighter than adults. We generally say less than 180 for adults overnight. But interestingly enough, for kids, they also have a lower number. We don't want it less than 90 before they go to sleep. So as you know, nighttime is the most frightening time of all for children and parents, making sure that blood sugar doesn't go too low. And then there's some more information down here that the goals should be individualized and blood sugar should be modified. Blood sugar goals based if children are having frequent low or they have hypoglycemia unawareness. And then we're going to measure postprandial blood sugars if there's a discrepancy between the pre-meal blood sugars and the A1C. So we're not always going to check those post-meal blood sugars because we know it's really difficult to ask a kid to check 8 times a day. So we want to maximize the information we get from these glucose checks without overburdening the children and the families. So we're going to have to set realistic blood sugar testing goals. The other thing that they address in these standards of care is the autoimmune conditions for type 1 diabetes. And they really clarified what screening should be done and what screening tools should we use. So we should assess for the presence of additional autoimmune conditions at diagnosis and if any symptoms of autoimmune conditions do develop. So we know that type 1 is an autoimmune disease and that the child or person living with type 1 is likely during their lifetime to express other autoimmune diseases. So they just go hand in hand. Autoimmune diseases in one person, they're more likely to express other autoimmune diseases besides the one like type 1 diabetes. So let me ask you this question. What is the most common autoimmune condition associated with type 1 diabetes? Is it thyroid disease? Is it celiac disease? Is it diabulimia? Or is it irritable bowel syndrome? What is the most common autoimmune condition associated with type 1 diabetes? Now go ahead and launch the poll and make your best guess. Okay, we have a close heat here. Okay, I'll take one more second for you all to vote. Okay, I'm going to close the poll. Thank you so much. Let me share this with you. Well, you definitely all got the top two. Thyroid disease is the most common autoimmune disease. It's almost 25% of kids when they're diagnosed with type 1 have thyroid disease. And then 30% of people with type 1 end up getting thyroid disease. And celiac disease, the rate of celiac associated with type 1 is 2 to 13%. So celiac disease, less common than thyroid disease. But those two are the most common autoimmune conditions associated with type 1 diabetes. So let's take a look at those. So how do we screen for pediatric celiac disease? Well, we first do a blood test. We measure the IgA anti-tissue transglutaminase or anti-endomysial antibodies. So it's a blood test. So when you're first diagnosed with type 1 or the child is diagnosed with type 1, it generally says to screen for celiac disease. It's not a hard and fast rule, but it's suggested. That's how I would say it. It's suggested to screen for celiac disease using this blood test. And then we certainly want to consider testing in children with a positive family history If they're so during the course of their diabetes, if they start exhibiting some symptoms and they've got a positive family history, somebody else has celiac, or they're not growing normally because celiac disease is a malabsorption syndrome. They don't absorb the nutrients in the villi of their intestines, so they're not gaining weight, and they complain of diarrhea, flatulence, abdominal pain, and they have unexplained hypoglycemia or deterioration of glycemic control. All reasons that we would be suspicious and test to see if they have these antibodies. So the antibody testing through the blood is a first screening step, and then we go on to step two. Asymptomatic children that have positive antibodies. So suppose you just screen somebody and they have positive antibodies, but they're not complaining of any symptoms, then we want to consider referral to gastroenterologist for evaluation with an endoscopy or biopsy for confirmation. But more common would be a child who's complaining of it, we get the positive antibodies, and then we are going to confirm it with a biopsy. So if we do confirm that they do have celiac disease with a gastrointestinal biopsy, then of course you know they need to go on a gluten-free diet and really need to get them in to see a dietitian experienced in managing both celiac and disease and diabetes, because those two have a very strong interrelationship and can affect blood sugar management and insulin. So really someone familiar with both conditions is desirable if we can do that. Okay, so here's thyroid disease. So hypothyroidism is the most common autoimmune condition, and what we'll see is initially that thyroids start growing because it's trying to make more and more thyroxine. So and then we'll see the TSH levels are going up because there's not enough thyroxine being produced. So the pituitary gland releases more thyroid stimulating hormone to tell the thyroid, hey, ramp it up. We don't have enough thyroxine. And so the thyroid enlarges to try and accommodate that increased demand. And so what we're going to do, as I've mentioned here about the prevalence, 25% positive for thyroid disease at diagnosis of type 1. So we're going to screen for two things, antithyroid peroxidase and antithyroglobulin antibodies. So we're going to look for those two. And then we're also going to look at thyroid stimulating hormone, TSH concentrations, but we have to wait till metabolic control has been established because when the blood sugars are high, it can really affect the TSH. We want to get them back to baseline. And if it's normal, we're going to consider rechecking every 1 to 2 years, but definitely be on the lookout for any symptoms of thyroid dysfunction, enlarged thyroid, abnormal growth, you know, they're not growing normally, or blood sugars are out of control. So we're going to always be looking for these other autoimmune conditions in our kids, adolescents, and adults actually with type 1 diabetes. So here's the poll question number 3. And I do want to say something that when we think about diabetes and type 1, people or children with type 1 diabetes have a higher risk of cardiovascular disease. And so we have to be very conscientious about managing their cardiovascular risk profile and helping prevent any cardiovascular event. So based on that, this is for type 1s. We'll talk about type 2s later, but type 1s do have a higher rate. Type 2s also have a higher rate of cardiovascular disease. So these goals apply to both type 1 and type 2 children with diabetes. So what is the blood pressure target for kids with type 1 or type 2? Is it less than 140 over 90? Is it B, less than 120 over 70? Is it C, depends on family genetics? Or D, less than 90th percentile for age, sex, and height? Let me go ahead and launch this poll. Okay, yeah, these are just new guidelines coming out for children. And they're just, you know, we're getting more data now so we know what goals are appropriate and treatment strategies. But certainly more data continues to be collected for this, you know, really vulnerable group of kids living with type 1 or type 2 diabetes. Okay, most of you have voted. Just take one more second if you haven't voted yet. I appreciate your voting and participation. I'm going to close the poll and share the answers with you. So Some of you said, you know what, let's just use the adult target of 140 over 90. 33% of you said, well, 120 over 70 sounds good. Nobody chose C, and 50% of you chose the right answer. Less than 90th percentile for age, sex, and height. So when it comes to blood pressure for adolescents, we don't have a hard and fast number. It's based on these factors. And in your resource page, what I've done is I've put a link to the NIH website where you can put in the child's age, height, weight, and it will tell you what is considered normal blood pressure and if they're above the 90th percentile. So it's a really nice link and resource for you. So screening for pediatric hypertension. We're going to measure blood pressure at each routine visit, and we're going to confirm high normal blood pressure on 3 separate days. So this is a serious diagnosis. So we want to make sure, A, we use the right size blood pressure cuff, and B, we're getting accurate readings. We have to confirm it on 3 separate days. Because if it is confirmed hypertension and they're above the 90th percentile, we're going to have to take action. And it's serious. So the first thing we're going to do is diet and exercise. And look what it says here, aimed at weight control. So if that child is overweight, helping them with weight management is really going to help get that blood pressure down. Also, if target is not reached within 3 to 6 months of lifestyle intervention, we're going to consider pharmacologic intervention. So 3 to 6 months and they still haven't got blood pressure down, we're going to have to really consider protecting their cardiovascular, their vessels, their eyes, and their kidneys by starting a pharmacologic intervention. So this is kind of tricky because these are young kids we're starting these meds on, but it seems to improve outcomes. So we're going to start an ACE or an ARB. These are both blood pressure medications, and they're very effective at lowering blood pressure, but these are teratogenic. So any girl of childbearing age who's on these medications. So this is a girl with type 1 or type 2 diabetes, and she's menstruating. We have to provide reproductive counseling because if she gets pregnant and she's on these, it can potentially harm the fetus. Very, very important point. And then what's the goal of treatment? So we said if they're above the 90th percentile, we need to get that blood pressure down, and here's the goal of treatment. Getting it below the 90th percentile is the target. So there's not one hard and fast rule till you enter adulthood. And I've placed a really helpful link so you could check that out. Now, what about dyslipidemia? So we know that when you have diabetes, you're more likely to have hypertension and hypercholesterolemia or dyslipidemia. So as soon as when we're going to get a fasting lipid profile in children over the age of 2, as soon after diagnosis and glucose control has been established. So we kind of need that blood sugar to normalize to get accurate readings for the lipids, but we're going to get it as soon as possible. And if lipids are abnormal, annual monitoring is reasonable. So we need to check those lipids annually. But if the LDL cholesterol levels are less than 100, which is considered accepted, we can repeat the lipid profile every 5 years. But if they're above that, we're going to check more frequently. So how do we help cholesterol management? Well, it's behavior change first, always. We're going to optimize blood glucose. When you get blood sugars down, you'll see triglycerides really improve, and many times LDL and HDL will improve. We're going to set them up with a dietitian to go over using medical nutrition therapy with a focus on decreasing saturated fat, limiting it to less than 7%, and dietary cholesterol less than 200 milligrams a day. And that's considered the step 2AH American Heart Association diet, and I've put a link for that in your resource page too. And they've shown that establishing this lower fat diet and lower cholesterol diet in children has no untoward effects, so that it's safe for these kids. But listen to this, if we've tried optimizing blood glucose and nutrition therapy and exercise, and the blood lipid levels are still elevated, we might have to go to pharmacologic intervention. So here it says, after the age of 10, statin treatment is reasonable if the LDL cholesterol is more than 160, or the LDL cholesterol is more than 130, and there's one other cardiovascular risk factor. And again, we need to provide reproductive counseling because, as you know, statins are very teratogenic. They're a category X. So any woman with childbearing age, or any girl of childbearing age or menstruating on a statin, we need to talk about contraception as appropriate. And the goal for this group of children is LDL cholesterol less than 100. So again, we're going to start with behavior change, MNT, exercise, but if still they've turned 10 years old and their lipid levels are elevated, we're going to have to start statin therapy. Wow. So let me ask you this question. When is it indicated to start a statin for pediatrics with diabetes? When LDL is greater than 100, after the age of 10, when LDL is more than 160, or both B and C? Let me launch this poll. All right, good job. I usually do these polls before I give you the data, but this time I asked afterward as a reinforcement of key points. So you guys are paying attention. This is terrific. Thank you so much. You're on fire, basically, is what I'm trying to say. Okay, let me close this poll and share the results. Yeah, both B and C. After the age of 10 and when LDL is more than 160. Those are the criteria. And of course, I didn't have room to put it in there, but also after we've tried, you know, MNT lifestyle changes, and those haven't succeeded. So that's part of the procedure also. Okay, great job, you guys. Thank you. I mean, to me, it's really kind of shocking to think that you would have an 11-year-old on a statin, but the data that they have so far shows that the children can tolerate the statin and it improves outcomes. And so we just want to be aware of these treatment alternatives for kids who are, you know, going to live for a lifetime with either type 1 or type 2 diabetes. So let's look at screening and treatment for pediatric nephropathy or kidney disease. We're going to screen annually for albumin levels. So we're going to keep an annual eye starting at the age of 10 or whichever is earlier. So at puberty or the age of 10 years of age, whichever is earlier, once the youth has had diabetes for 5 years. So, you know, you don't want to check screen for nephropathy if they are 5 years of age. We usually wait till puberty or age of 10 after they've had diabetes for 5 years because kidney disease takes a while to occur. We're going to do random spot urine sample for albumin to creatinine ratio, and we're also going to measure creatinine clearance and GFR at initial evaluation, and then we'll repeat based on their risk, their age, duration, and treatment. And here's what treatment says. We're going to start an ACE inhibitor if they're having urinary albumin creatinine ratio more than 30 milligrams confirmed on 2 of 3 urine samples from different days over 6 months. So if we're noticing that their ratio is above 30, we're going to initiate ACE, a blood pressure medication to protect their kidneys. But again, it has to be confirmed on 2 of 3 urine samples from different days over 6 months. Okay, so this is just, they're trying to standardize the treatment and the screening for type 1s. Now, what about eye disease? What are the retinopathy screening guidelines for type 1? Well, we're going to consider initial dilated and comprehensive eye exam, the same parameters at the start of puberty or after 10 years of age, whichever is earlier, once a youth has had diabetes for 3 to 5 years, so a little bit different. And so, again, we don't want to start screening until it's really going to be reveal disease. We don't want to do it just to do it. We want to be thoughtful on what we ask of our patients. And after the initial examination, we're going to do annual routine follow-up. And less examinations may be acceptable if the eyes are healthy and the blood pressure and the blood glucose levels are within target based on the advice of the eye professional. Now, what about neuropathy screening? And I put kidneys here. I'm sorry about that. But the kidneys should have gone on the last slide. I wonder where they went off to. But for neuropathy, we want to look at their foot exam. So we're going to consider an annual foot exam again, starting at puberty or the age of 10, once the youth has had diabetes for about 5 years. And so we're going to take a look at their feet and do a monofilament testing to see if they have any neuropathy. Now, education and support is going to be really important, and any child with type 1 diabetes should receive self-management education and support at diagnosis and routinely thereafter. And of course, it's not only the kid with the diabetes, but also the family or support people or caregivers, whoever that's going to be. We need to make sure our information is sensitive to their culture, it's sensitive to their developmental stage, and is individualized. So this is going to be ongoing education and support throughout their lifetime. Let's take a look at this. Jason has had type 1 diabetes for 7 years and is turning 18 this year. What will help him make a successful transition to diabetes self-care as an adult? Is it A, encourage complete autonomy, B, moving to his own apartment, C, requiring he pay for his own diabetes supplies, or D, providing support and resources? So this transition time is a big deal for kids moving to adulthood, and now, they've had a lot of support. I mean, in the past, their family has been involved intimately in their diabetes control, perhaps some families not as involved. And now they're moving on to adulthood, and it's a really tricky time for them. So what would most likely help them succeed during this transition? Okay. It's pretty, from your responses, I'm thinking that answer is pretty obvious. Although if you all have any teenagers living at your house, you might be thinking B sounds really good. Let me close this and share with you. Yeah, it's providing support and resources. So it's a really, as I mentioned, difficult time. They're moving from having a lot of people help them with their diabetes to now, hey, you're on your own. And this is really vulnerable for them. And so we want to prepare the teen at least 1 year prior to that transition. And both pediatricians and healthcare providers should really be involved in assisting with links and resources and support for the teen and emerging adult. I like that. They're emerging as an adult. It takes time to do that. And we want to make sure that the family is involved in these tasks and recognize that if we push them too quickly, that it can result in non-adherence and deterioration of glycemic control. So as with any teen, we need to be sensitive to how quickly we push them to become independent and move into adulthood and be really, receptive to that and aware of that. So recommendations for pediatric psychosocial issues. So a kid and the family with diabetes, it really affects the family and from an emotional psychosocial perspective. So we want to be sensitive to that. At diagnosis and during routine follow-up, assess psychosocial issues and family stress that can impact adherence with diabetes. And sometimes I'll have a kid that comes in with, I call him a frequent flyer with DKA in our hospital. And it's not because he doesn't know about diabetes and how to manage it. There's some stressor happening at home. And so we need to look at those stressors and find out how they're impacting their ability to do successful diabetes self-care and see if we can't get them some support. They might need social work or some counseling or some family intervention, but just being aware that frequent hospitalization is often a sign of something happening at home. And we really, if we have access to a mental health professional experienced in childhood diabetes, that's great. I don't in my community, so I'm just happy with any assistance that I can get from our social workers and our counselors. I really appreciate it. Ongoing care for type 1, we want to make sure they keep seeing their provider every 3 months, and they might need help from a behavioral specialist or a lifestyle coach. And they need to see their CDE and RD at least yearly. This is part of the standards. We want to evaluate for frequency of hypoglycemia each visit and look for normal growth and development. And if it is delayed, we want to see if they're running high blood sugars. So if they're running high blood sugars, it means they're not getting enough insulin. Insulin's a growth hormone. So lack of insulin or not enough insulin can stunt growth. And we want to look if they're having any celiac or thyroid disease. And we can screen this every 1 to 2 years. And interestingly enough, depression screening. So living with a chronic disease has been associated with depression. So we want to just check in with our patients and our family to see if that's an issue for them. And the other thing I was mentioning was TrialNet. So TrialNet is a wonderful resource. And I've just met people just randomly in my regular life outside of my work life, and they were telling me that their kid has type 1 diabetes, newly diagnosed. I'm like, oh my gosh, you've got to go to TrialNet. And just in the past month, I've met two people with newly diagnosed children with type 1. I sent them to TrialNet, and now they're involved in studies because it was really unusual. I met them within 3 months of their child's diagnosis. And so now they're hooked up with TrialNet, and they're getting information from them. And now they're doing genetic screening of not only the child, but the family, and also involved in intervention or natural history studies. So as diabetes educators, I think it's just imperative that we let anyone with living with type 1 diabetes and their family know about this resource. And you can see they will mail screening packets to you, or trial information to you through the mail, and you can just mail back and forth. You don't actually have to physically drive anywhere. They've really improved the process. So this is amazing. I would just really encourage you to let your families and patients know about that with type 1 diabetes. Okay, so we're going to move on to type 2 diabetes. Now, which factor puts children at higher risk of getting type 2? Is it A, higher income families, B, living in rural areas, C, limited education, or D, eating a lot of sweets? Which factor puts children at higher risk of getting type 2? And we actually know the factors now from the TODAY trial. So we have good data on this. What puts kids at higher risk? Thanks for voting, everyone. I appreciate it. I'm going to go ahead and close this. Okay. So nobody chose A. Good. 17% of you chose B, living in rural areas. No, that hasn't been associated with a higher risk of type 2. Actually, a lot of kids living in rural areas tend to have a little bit better health than kids living in cities because they have more access to being outdoors and, more physically active and safer. What about C, limited education? 33% of you chose that. That is the right answer. D is not the right answer, eating a lot of sweets, because there's kids who eat a lot of sweets but never become overweight or don't have the genetics for type 2. So that's really not counted as a risk, but certainly limited education is a risk factor for type 2. And let's take a look at that. This is the TODAY trial I've been talking about. And what they're doing is following kids over time and seeing who gets type 2 diabetes and why they're getting type 2 diabetes, and looking at that environmental factors surrounding that. So there's been a sevenfold increase in type 2 since 1990. I mean, the rate is just soaring in our children. One in six overweight kids in America right now, that's about, 20%, have prediabetes. So if the children are overweight, we know they're at risk for prediabetes, and certainly at risk for diabetes in the future. We have about 2,500 to 3,700 new cases of type 2 in youth annually. And here's the highest risk: very obese, minority, female, low socioeconomic status, limited education. So our high-risk populations are here. So we want to really direct our education and public health policy and look at decreasing health disparities for our communities. Let's see. Environmental changes are urgently needed. Environmental changes. So we definitely want to support an environment that is more healthy. Currently, we would call our environment obesogenic, and that is, you go outside or you go to a liquor store, the first thing you're driving in when you're hungry, you pull into a liquor store. When you walk in, you are confronted with chips, sodas, candies. Those are the first things that people see when they go to liquor stores. And even grocery stores, that center part of the grocery store is really dangerous. That's all the high-fat foods. So our environment is supporting obesity. People aren't out and walking like they used to be. And many times, these groups that are highest risk don't live in places where it's safe to walk. So we definitely really want to think about how could we be involved in environmental changes. And when I think about engaging our children to help slow the epidemic, I'm also thinking of engaging the parents or the caregivers, and that is we want to look at the environment and improving access to safe places to exercise, encouraging healthy foods, learning-rich environments, access to health care, because when kids have access to health care, they do better. And then lifestyle, we can limit screen time to 2 hours a day, 1 hour a day of movement, eating healthy, limit junk food, sugary beverages, and increasing the food and beverages. So there's certainly different things we can do through lifestyle and environment to decrease that risk of prediabetes. And I kind of think a lot about women in particular, because here's this little girl, and if she eats healthily and exercises and stays at a great weight like she is here before she gets pregnant, if she has risk for diabetes in her family, she's less likely to pass on the genetics for type 2 diabetes to this little baby. So we know that if a woman gets gestational diabetes during her pregnancy, she's more likely to get diabetes during her lifetime, and her child is more likely to be obese and have prediabetes, diabetes, and insulin resistance. So can we really reach out to our children and say, you know, move into adulthood as healthy as possible, and when you do get pregnant, if you're a girl, of course, try and not gain more than 40 pounds, and if you're overweight, maybe less than that, and maybe we can slow down this epidemic of diabetes. We want to leave the best health legacy we can to our children. So who should we screen for type 2s? Which children and adolescents? Well, we definitely know being overweight is the biggest risk factor. So if the BMI is more than 85% for age and sex, weight, and height, or more than 120% of ideal weight for height, then they're at risk. So basically overweight or obese kids, but here's an objective way of measuring that. Plus, if they have any two of the following risk factors, they're at higher risk. They have higher chances of getting diabetes, or they have insulin resistance if they have that acanthosis nigricans, and these are all manifestations of insulin resistance. And acanthosis nigricans is when the skin gets really dark and thick, and there's oftentimes skin tags. That tells us that child is at risk for diabetes and hypertension. Or if they have hypertension, they have high cholesterol, polycystic ovary syndrome, or if they were small for gestational age at birth weight. Interestingly enough, kids who were a low birth weight have higher risk of diabetes because they think in utero they became more insulin resistant, and that insulin resistance carries on through their lifetime. If the mom had GDM during the child's gestation, the kid's at higher risk. Family history, and there's these different ethnic groups that have higher rates of type 2. So if a kid is at risk, we'll test at 10 years, that number keeps coming up, or puberty, and then every 3 years. So we're on the lookout for these children at high risk for diabetes. In 2013, a summary of the management of newly diagnosed type 2 diabetes in kids and adolescents was released by the American Academy of Pediatrics. And this was really the first really clear guideline on how to manage type 2 in children. So we've been talking about managing type 1. Now we're going to talk about type 2 in children and adolescents. And both of these articles that I'm referencing, or all of the articles, are in your resource page. So I would really encourage you to take a look at those. Now let's think about type 2 clinical presentation in kids. Many times they come in with glycosuria, but no ketoneuria. So let's think about the pathology of type 2. So type 2 means you're insulin resistant, but you still make insulin, just less of it. Here's the fascinating thing. 33% of these kids have ketoneuria. And I was telling you, what does ketoneuria signify? It means that you don't make enough insulin. When we think about ketoneuria, we usually think of type 1. But 33% of kids with type 2 are actually burning fat for fuel. Why is that? Well, one theory is that they're so glucose toxic that their beta cells are just shut down. And then when we give them some insulin, their beta cells revive, and actually we'll see that the ketosis stops. So sometimes it's hard with kids to tell if they're type 1 or type 2, because a lot of kids who come in with type 1 are overweight, and we used to think, well, they're overweight type 2, but now a lot of kids with type 1, since, you know, 20 to 30% of our children are overweight, are coming in overweight, even though they've lost some weight. So we might have to draw antibodies antibodies to see are they type 1 or type 2 to verify diagnosis. But regardless, many children will need insulin during that acute phase, during that glucose toxic phase, because their beta cells are just shut down. Now, for type 2 clinical presentation, mild thirst, increased urination, little or no weight loss. So type 2 is a lot harder to detect in kids. They may just be kind of, a little more thirsty than usual. Their weight doesn't really seem to change. They may seem more tired or getting more infections, but it might be harder to detect. So that's why it's really important to screen those at high risk. So identify who's at risk and screen on a regular basis. But look at this, since it's not detected, at onset may have retinopathy, microalbuminuria, hypertension, and hyperlipidemia. So this type 2 may go on undiagnosed for years. That's why we really want to catch it, because these complications can ensue unbeknownst to the child or the family. Let's take a look at this next poll question. An 11-year-old comes into the emergency room with symptoms of new hyperglycemia and an A1C of 9.2%. What treatment must be started? And this is a type 2. Is it A, insulin therapy? Is it B, try changes in diet immediately? Is it C, start exercise program stat? Or is it D, only B and C? Let me launch this poll. All right, thank you for voting, everybody. All right, take a few more seconds. There's a tie happening here. I can see it on the screen. We're at 50-50 right now, so we'll see which one wins. Okay, I'm going to close and share with you. So 50% of you said, let's start insulin therapy, and the other 50% of you said, let's work on diet and exercise program stat. So the correct answer is actually A, start insulin therapy. And the reason is because when you're that glucose toxic, to help immediately get the beta cells working and functioning and protecting them, insulin therapy is indicated. So these are the new guidelines put out by the American Academy of Pediatrics. They were also the American Diabetes Association and the American Academy of Nutrition Sciences sat in and helped write these recommendations. So it's a big effort. It's a collaboration by those three organizations. So it says for new type 2, start insulin if they're 10 to 18 years old with new onset hyperglycemia and the blood glucose is 250 or greater, the A1C is 9% or greater, and they have, these are actually or, so it's either or. Blood glucose more than 250 or A1C more than 9% or they have ketosis and we're not sure if they're type 1 or type 2. So these are all indications to start insulin therapy. And look at out what it says. Look at what it says here. Even if it turns out a ketone positive child is type 2, insulin therapy helps stop glucose toxicity so beta cells can rest and recover. So it won't harm them. And actually, there's some research that if we start kids on insulin when they come in, even with type 2 diabetes, it really signifies this is a serious condition. You need to pay attention. Because as you can imagine, a lot of these kids are lost to follow-up. The new type 2s, they get lost in the system, especially if their parents are moving and they're changing schools or pediatricians. So some of the research indicates that insulin therapy really helps the family understand the significance of this problem. Let me ask you this question. Which of the following medication is FDA approved for pediatrics after the age of 10? This is for treatment of type 2 diabetes. Is it A, glipizide, B, metformin, C, sitagliptin, or D, acarbose? And if you're taking the exam in the future, they always list the drugs with the generic and the trade names together. So which one of these is FDA approved for pediatrics? Wow, this was a no-brainer. You guys are on fire on this one. Okay, great. I'm going to go ahead and close this. And 100% of you chose metformin or glucophage. And that, in fact, is the only oral medication that is approved by the FDA for kids starting at the age of 10. And I'm really glad it is because it has so many benefits. As you know, metformin lowers the blood sugar, the A1C, 1 to 2 percentage points. Plus, it helps many times with weight management or weight loss, and it helps the lipids. So great, a great first starting medication. The main thing about it is it can cause some GI side effects. So you could, make sure they eat it with meals, and extended release can also be trialed. So type 2, new diagnosis, if the A1C is not too high or they're not glucose toxic, we're going to initiate lifestyle modification program and start metformin therapy. When they looked at the TODAY trial, less than 10% of children with type 2 diabetes attain blood glucose goals with lifestyle change alone, 10%. So they say just go ahead and start metformin with exercise and healthy eating. Just start all three of those together. And you can imagine these kids are getting type 2 diabetes when they're, 12. They're going to have it for over 60 years, depending on how long they live. So you can imagine most of these kids will end up on insulin therapy eventually because their pancreas is probably not going to be able to last that long, with the process. Because type 2, the natural history is beta cells continue to be destroyed over time. So what are the goals as far as A1C for our type 2? Well, they're a little bit different than our type 1s. Our type 1s, as you recall, were less than 7.5, but with our type 2s, they are using the ADA adult targets, and that is A1C less than 7%. But individual goals may be adjusted depending on what is realistic for the family. So it could be that A1C could be a little bit higher. Maybe it's 7.5 if that family is really struggling, or maybe the family says, you know what, we really want to get this A1C down. Let's get it towards 6.5. So it just really depends on the therapy, the family's ability, and the goals that are, when you're choosing these goals. We're going to monitor the A1C every 3 months and intensify a treatment if goals not being met. And they do actually have a pre-meal blood glucose target. I just added this to your slide of 80 to 130. So, and very similar to the adult goals. So kids with type 2 diabetes, since they're insulin resistant and insulin deficient, they're not at as high risk of hypoglycemia. So our goals are a little bit different with them. They just, they're still making some insulin. They're usually not, don't have hypoglycemia unawareness, and they're more likely to run high because of the resistance. So we can set the targets a little bit more conservative. Now, what about healthy eating? Many of these kids with type 2 diabetes really have not been set up for success in their families. As you know, what a child eats is heavily influenced by what his family brings home or provides for them. And at least in the schools, we have some momentum now as far as more healthy choices. But what is a kid going to choose? This beautiful basket of fruit or all these pastries? And believe me, kids are presented with junk food all the time throughout the day. So it's constantly trying to make the better decision. It's hard for the kids. And that's why when they talk about how to decrease this epidemic, environmental changes are desperately needed. So we definitely want to incorporate evidence-based nutrition guidelines as published by the American Nutrition and Dietetics Association. And, these strategies here are nothing new. You all could tell me them. Eat regular meals, reduce portion sizes, really avoid sugary beverages, limit juice to 1 cup per day. A lot of people think, oh, juice is healthy, I'll drink a lot of it. Well, it still has a lot of calories and many times added sugar. Limit high-fat foods, choose less fat. Fast foods. So easily said in this slide, more difficult to translate into action by the family. And so certainly involving the family in a sensitive, culturally appropriate way is going to be the key to success here. The other thing is getting active. We want our kids to engage in at least 60 minutes of exercise a day and limit non-academic screen time to less than 2 hours. And really looking at an individualized approach that's realistic for the family and considers the family's culture, the child's physical ability, and their preferences. So we just can't tell a kid, okay, buy a bike and start riding it. We have to say, what do you all do as a family usually? How could you increase this activity? So let's do one more poll question. When working with kids and families with type 2 diabetes, which approach works best to support behavior change? A, take time to understand their perception of diabetes self-care. B, gently support avoidance of sugary treats. C, remind them about the risk of complications. Or D, remind them that unless they make changes, insulin may be required. What is the, which approach would work best? All right. Yeah, you guys, this is, I could tell it was too easy of a question, or maybe you guys are just, you know, just so smart. Either, but or both could be right. You're super smart and the question was too easy or too obvious. So A, take time to understand their perception of diabetes self-care. This is really important, the most important thing, you know, to do so that we can help them succeed. So here's some behavior change bullet points. We want to engage youth and family in decision making. This is, you know, just the adult learning theory taken to the child, and that is we want to make sure that they are participating in the decisions. If they don't participate, it's probably not going to happen. And we want to foster medication adherence. A lot of times they'll start on the metformin, they just stop taking it. They don't get the prescription refilled because you don't feel diabetes. You know what I mean? You don't feel bad. It doesn't hurt initially. When you get complications, it does, but it's hard to take a medication for something you can't see. Goals have to be realistic. We want to understand the family's perception, dispel any myths. And because type 2 disproportionately affects minority populations, we need to really be sensitive to that and focus on family-centered care and really supporting environmental changes. So this is just a summary. For type 2s, nutrition therapy, physical activity, realistic exercise, medications include metformin and often insulin, and really making sure we provide them with social support and referral so they can succeed on an ongoing basis. You know, risk reduction is critical. If you're going to live with a chronic condition for over 60 years, we need to help prevent complications. And we can do that by talking about vaccinations, oral care, eye exams, looking at getting the blood sugar, lipids, and blood pressure to target, helping with lifetime weight management and smoking. Such a big deal, especially with e-cigarettes. E-cigarettes are not recommended. Those are vaping, where you're pulling in nicotine through this device that looks really cool. A lot of kids are doing it now. We need to have the conversation about vaping, e-cigarettes, because it's still pulling in the nicotine and other toxins into their body. And it's, you know, nicotine increases insulin resistance and is just not good for your health overall. Keep active, get support, and other. So treatment standards for type 2 diabetes, this is from, now I'm going back to the American Diabetes Association recommendation. It says, due to the significant comorbidities associated with type 2, these tests are recommended at diagnosis, blood pressure, lipid, albumin, how well their kidneys are working, and dilated eye exam. Thereafter, screening and treatment guidelines for youth with type 2 are similar to youth with type 1. So again, if their blood pressure is elevated, we're going to start them on an ACE or an ARB. If their cholesterol is elevated and they don't respond to medical nutrition therapy and exercise, and they're over the age of 10, we're going to start a statin, and we're going to, you know, really help protect against cardiovascular events. So for the next 10 minutes or so, let's talk about the work of diabetes and some normal growth and development expectations. And when I think about the work of diabetes, we call it self-care. But to people with diabetes, it's the work. It's the daily drudgery of all the stuff you have to do to reach these targets. And so we're going to talk about blood sugar testing, giving insulin, timing, meal planning, and prevention of low blood sugars. And lots of times when we're teaching our families who are, you know, have this new diagnosis, they're in grief, denial, shock. So we're going to need to provide lots of reassurance, support, and information, yet try not to overwhelm them. So you just see that look of overwhelmness. We need to give them things that they can read on their own and just check in with them on a regular basis. So as far as blood sugar testing, we want to keep it real. No one likes getting poked. Kids don't like it. Adults don't like it. So let's not ask people to do more than what is going to really benefit them. If they're on metformin and they're on oral medications, maybe once to two times a day may be adequate. Maybe once a day. We're going to negotiate all of this. If they're on insulin, we really like to check three times a day, and that's for type 1s or type 2s. And we want to talk about rotation, using fine lens sets, poking in a place on the side of the finger, not the center, and the benefits of a log or downloading their results. So ketone testing. We usually test ketones in our type 1s, and a lot of times with our type 1s, this can they get ketone positive when they're insulin deficient, and this often happens during illness. So if they test the ketones, you can test it in your urine, and there's now glucose meters that will also test if you're ketotic in the blood. So that's really good. And if that does happen, they need to contact their provider, and extra fluids and insulin are required. I've seen people that are just, kids really great at their diabetes self-management, and they get sick and they get ketone positive. They're taking extra insulin and they just can't get that blood sugar down. So they need support during this time of if they're positive ketones and some problem solving around that. Now, injecting insulin, as you know, there's a lot of issues around insulin injection. There's phobias, there's mythology, there's all kinds of stuff. So as educators, we really want to try and help alleviate the fear around insulin injections. We can try pens. The pens look really groovy and cool. But the thing is, what if you don't have good insurance? If you don't have good insurance, the pens are very expensive. So we have to really evaluate the insurance and their financial status before we recommend these more expensive products. There's auto injectors where you don't really see the needle and it retracts immediately. Again, those are more expensive, but something that we could consider. We always want to use the short or mini or nano needles, or insulin pens have very small needles, and use the smallest barrel possible, usually the 30-unit syringe. And there are insulin syringes that can pull up half-unit increments if you need to do that. Your patient is very insulin sensitive. When the kids are young, they inject insulin in their legs, arm, and buttocks, and as they get older and entering school, they can also use their abdomen. The other thing with needle phobias is an insulin pump. And here's a kid here with an Omnipod. And the Omnipods are pretty cool because there's no wiring, there's no tubing connected to it. It's just kind of self-contained. It holds 200 units of insulin in that little Omnipod. And then there's like this remote where you can deliver the insulin as needed. And this little remote device, insulin management tool or something, also has a way to check your blood sugars. So, just these pumps, you only change, every 72 hours, also offer a little break from needles if the children are really struggling. So a lot more younger and younger kids are using insulin pumps and having great success, and hopefully we'll have an artificial pancreas in the near future, which would be really great. So dosing of insulin, it may be low during the honeymoon period. Remember we said there might be some beta cells, 15 to 35% of the beta cells still might be churning out some insulin. So they may need very little. I've had lots of patients during this phase that only need some basal insulin. It depends on the patient and where they're at with their diabetes. But after the honeymoon is over, the dose is really based on their body weight, and it's 0.5 to 1 units of insulin per kilogram per day. And we try and imitate what the pancreas would do through basal and bolus insulin combinations. And then as they move into puberty, they have this real increase in insulin resistance. And so we might notice that we have to sometimes double the insulin requirement. And girls, as they start getting their periods, might have some more insulin resistance or insulin sensitivity around that time. We need to keep it flexible. And if the kid isn't sure how much they're going to eat, they might actually inject insulin after a meal. And so we want to keep working with the families. This is going to be an ongoing relationship where we're going to help them problem solve and work with their growing child, because the child is going to have this push-pull thing where they want help and attention and support, but then they might push the parents away and say, "I can do this on my own." So that's a real can be a real struggle for the families too. Hypoglycemia, we need to put a special focus on that because that's really terrifying. Fear of hypoglycemia is a big barrier to blood sugar control. And 10 to 20% of the peds extra exercise is responsible for that low blood sugar event. So we really want to talk about the impact of exercise and see how it affects the blood sugar, because we might need to, if they're on a pump, reduce the insulin delivery during exercise or even afterward. So exercise can lower blood sugar 1 to 16 hour post-event. So kind of helping the patient and the families keep track of how when exercise kicks in for them. We might need to prevent it, to provide extra carb. We might have to do a 3 a.m. blood sugar check, or we could, you know, support them getting that continuous glucose monitor, which can alert the person and the family to when the blood sugar is too low. And lots of parents, you know, are overwhelmed with the fear and stress of learning all these new skills and responsibilities, and it can really lead to some family conflict. So really getting support and interdisciplinary team is critical during this time, especially a member with a mental health background can really be useful and really necessary. And so just to wrap up, you know, we think about when we're teaching our children with type 1 or type 2 diabetes, we want to consider what stage are they at in their development, and we want to kind of gear our instruction based on where they're at. And if we think about Erickson's stages of psychosocial development, they're listed here. I'm not going to spend too much time on there. But, you know, we kind of change the way we interact with the world over time. And we certainly, by stage 5, are moving on to more independence. And, you know, when they're adolescents, certainly moving toward peer relationships become more important. But you can imagine if you have a little toddler, an infant with type 1 diabetes, this is very difficult to manage. They require lots of sleeps and nap. They eat unpredictably. So in this situation, many times we give insulin after the meals. And they're so kind of vulnerable or fragile. If they get sick or dehydrated, their blood sugars can really get out of control. So being in close communication with the healthcare team is important. Now, as they move... So during this stage, we want to direct the education, of course, mostly to the parents and caregivers, and providing the kids with limited choices really seems to help. Do you want your shot in your left arm or your right arm? And since the kids may not be able to communicate that they're low, the parents need to identify and look for signs of hypoglycemia with their child. So preschool children, one of my favorite stages, they engage in magical thinking. They do a lot of play therapy. So sharing with, you know, like this playing doctor or getting them a doll where they can give injections is really seems to help. They're concerned about the intactness of their body. Like if they give an insulin shot, will organs fall out? So they don't really understand and have a hard time conceptualizing how the body works. So just reassuring them or putting a Band-Aid can help. And again, very limited choices. And this is the time where they're entering preschool or daycare, so we need to provide the preschool and daycare with instruction and have a plan in case their blood sugar goes too low or too high. Now, as they enter school age, you know, now they can talk, they can identify low blood sugar. Still, games are good teaching tools. And a lot of times, as a kid moves toward teenagers, the parents may back off a little bit, but the parents really need to be there and assume most of the responsibility. They're not ready for that independence, even though they might act that way. But of course, the child is going to participate in self-care, and we're going to try and fit their diabetes into their normal routine. Now, adolescence is a tricky time. Even if you don't have diabetes, it's a tricky time. The hormones increase insulin resistance, and you know, lack of diabetes control may be actually a response to a stress in the family or family dysfunction. They're really concerned about image and how their peers are viewing them. And so we're going to have to still be engaged with them and supporting them in the best way possible, in a real non-judgmental way. The other thing about the teenage years is that's a time of risk-taking and exploration. And so we really want to talk to them about these different issues: substance abuse, eating disorders, sexuality, contraception, and driving. We want to make sure that if they are going to drink alcohol, they eat. We don't condone drinking alcohol, but we know teenagers have done this for hundreds of years. And so if you're going to drink, you have to eat. So giving them instructions around that. Before you get behind the wheel, you've got to check your blood sugar. And then if the girl is menstruating, we have to have a discussion about contraception. Of course, we're going to, get the permission of the parents, but many times we'll see the patient alone, the teenager, and then we'll see the patient and the parent together so that the teenager or the youth has an opportunity to share information with us they may not want the parent to hear. When we think about working with teens, we just want to really avoid being judgmental and set realistic goals. Real life meal planning, like if you're going to go out to McDonald's, what are some choices you could, have? And then gradual increase of responsibility, not just switching them over and releasing them at the age of 18. We need to prepare for that. As far as children at school, the American Diabetes Association has a lot of great resources. I just took a picture from their website today, diabetes.org, and they have legal protection, written care plans, resolving challenges. They have a whole team of experts who are working on legislation. They're talking to the school nurses. They're making sure that children with diabetes get the access and resources they need to be safe at school. And so this has really resulted in a lot of legislative changes and improvement in care. So you can take a look at that and let your patients' families know that the American Diabetes Association is working on their behalf. So really great resource. If you think about it, people with diabetes are protected by the Disabilities Education Act and the American Disabilities Act. So no person with diabetes should be discriminated against, and the federal law does require an individual assessment of child, and they need to make accommodations in the school setting for anyone with type 1 diabetes. So there's lots of organizations out there making sure that schools accommodate children with type 1 diabetes. So as far as ongoing family education and support, diabetes diagnosis can cause a lot of emotional response from the family and from the person with diabetes. We want to make sure we engage the family members in self-management education and really develop strategies so the family can succeed, provide them with a lot of resources for coping, and really following up with them over time to see if they need more assistance. So I want to thank you so much for joining us. If you have any questions afterwards, you can email me or join us on our website, diabetesed.net. And I want to thank you for your time and participation. And I want to thank you for sharing this information with the families and children that you're working with. I'll be signing off, but I will stay for any questions that you might have remaining off the recording. And thank you so much for joining us. This is Beverly Tomasian. Signing off.